Is your internet good on the boat?
I'm on the front of the boat. I just posted a video. I literally got done with an interview 5 minutes ago. You left me. I understand. But
I waited. Do you know how long I waited for you? You know how long? Why should I be here? Just because you're there? What happened?
I have a slightly better vibe than yesterday about Dubai, by the way, in case you're wondering.
Well, I'm glad you stayed. Number two, like, why? Is something interesting on the boat now, or what's happening?
Well, I mean, it's sunset. As you know, because you interviewed them, the entire cast and crew of Miss World is present. A lot of very interesting people, a lot of content being shot. It's just a pretty wild scene when you're just looking out at yachts. Not too bad. The weather's improved dramatically, but excited to get spaces. You and I have spent the day once again just talking and talking and talking.
Yeah, man. Well, you talked like fucking crazy. I kept mine short. The first one we did, it was meant to be 3 minutes. We did 7 minutes. Second one, you know, probably 10, 15. I waited for you and waited for you and waited for you. And everyone's like, Mario, just tell him to stop. I'm like, I can't.
I know.
You didn't stop talking. You don't stop talking, man. How long are your shows?
Well, this one was meant to be 30 minutes to an hour, and I just did a couple of them. I appreciate you trying to wait. Brock Pierce was interesting, huh?
Yeah, Brock Pierce is Brock Pierce. But yeah, just for anyone listening, we're talking 2049. We went to a side event. You know, I was invited. Scott was invited. So one of our projects is doing a big launch party there. I don't know why you were there, Scott, but it was a pleasure to have you.
On the boat. Yeah.
On the boat. And we finally spent the day together. Finally. And then Scott is, I agree. Like on the mic and on Twitter, he just sounds direct as fuck. In real life, he's one of the kindest people you'd meet. But when he's frustrated, he's just anxious. Just stay out of his way. That's probably the best tip I could give you. So when he's not anxious, hug him, chat with him, joke with him. Anything triggers him, or he's annoyed, his kids want to chat to him, he doesn't have time, he's sleepy, just walk away. That's what I learned about Scott, but it was a good time.
All good vibes today. And interestingly, I think we kind of have the market bouncing a bit, although I haven't had much opportunity to check it. And it looks like the halving will, in fact, be on 420. Brock, we were sitting there, Mario and I were sitting with Brock Pierce doing an interview with five or six of us. And Brock was checking it in real time because he really passionately wants it to be on 420 and not 419.
And it's going to be, is it looking at 420? What was it looking like, Scott? All right, your mic cut out. Does anyone know when the halving is going to be, 4:20 or 4:19?
He was saying 7 a.m. 7:15 a.m. is what he said about 2 hours ago on 4:20 UTC. So early in the morning UTC, 4:20.
Yeah. But it was an interesting discussion. I think one thing we really focused on, which we talked about, I think yesterday, the day before the show, is the Bitcoin ecosystem. You know, Simon Dixon would probably love that episode. And just talking about how, well, we kind of simplified it on that show because we're talking to TradFi, but it's actually the Bitcoin ecosystem. You know, taking up a lot of liquidity, taking up a lot of attention, and rightly so. And then that kind of Brock made a really interesting point. It's like, when you're king, you don't need to be first. And you could take your time. And now we're just seeing a lot of the use cases on different chains moving to Bitcoin. You know, doing it, you know, okay.
I had to post this photo, guys, above in the nest. I know why Mario's laughing, because he was literally interviewing like Miss World, Miss Europe, Miss Caribbean, Miss whatever. But Mario is about 6 feet tall, right? Ish.
Yeah, man.
Look how tall Miss World is.
It's insane. Yeah.
Look, you're sitting next to her on the same couch.
Yeah, yeah. Oh,
okay. No, when she stands up, talk about Bitcoin.
She stood up, I remember she stood up, and I was looking for you guys, and I couldn't find you guys, and then I found out you were behind her, and you're pretty tall as well. But now going back to the point, I think just looking at the markets, maybe give us a quick overview on the markets and your take so far. And you've spent more time at events and stuff. You're the more social person. But what's your take of Token 2049? And please don't talk about the floods again. What's the sentiment like? What narratives?
As you know, I haven't been to Token 2049, just like you. I haven't gotten even within miles of it, to be quite honest. But I think you come to enough of these conferences, you kind of know what the conversations are, and you see them on the side. And it's all the narratives that we, I think, talk ad nauseum about on this show. I will say, you know, RWA being a huge narrative, DPIN being a huge narrative, really a resurgence of DeFi, a huge, huge amount of conversation surrounding building on Bitcoin, obviously, right? A conversation I continue to have is, you know, were Ethereum and Solana and all these just a test net for the eventual building of Bitcoin? I obviously don't believe that. You know, I'm a multi-chain world guy. But to the point you sort of eloquently said about Brock before, that, you know, he was saying that you're the biggest, you can take your time and pick and choose the things that are going to work. But there's a lot of excitement. I will say on the, I'm not going to say on the negative side, but I think as naturally happens when price consolidates or things change with price, you hit this conference and there are conversations, quite a few of them, with people sort of saying, I wonder if the top really could be in. Which makes me think, by the way, that it's not. But, you know, if you, I think, had this conference 1 month ago, you would have gone and it would have been every person, consensus, 12 to 18 more months of insane bull market, which, by the way, I still, like, I lean way heavy in that direction. But now you do have people saying, uh-oh, did we miss it? What if it's the top? Have you heard that in these conversations?
Not really. I don't have the same conversations as you do. I'm just like, I go in, do my thing, and leave as quickly as I can. But let's go to the panel. Just kind of give a quick market update. And I'm glad you kind of gave us a... We'll talk a bit more about Token 2049. I'm going there tomorrow. That's my day I speak. I'm not sure if you're going to be there as well. You have to if I'm going there.
I'll come with you.
I appreciate it. We've become best bros, haven't we? But tomorrow, tonight, we might go to Rand's party. I'm still contemplating that, Scott. But just going to the panel.
We're going by boat.
You're going by boat. I'm just going to go normally. I'm home now. But let's just go back to the markets. Like, what happens next? And I think just going to talk, maybe moving to Joe. And funny enough, you talk about meme coins. I know you gave us a whole speech on Paris Blockchain Week. No one talks about meme coins. Yeah, well, we want to take that back now because, you know, we're on a boat with a lot of Bitcoin OGs.
I'm on a boat full of Bitcoiners, but I literally just watched an interview with the anonymous, not to me now, but founders of SHIB. And the interviewer was sitting in a chair and a SHIB pillow was sitting in the other chair. And the guy was giving the interview from behind the camera so that he wouldn't be seen.
Yeah, not only that. We've met him as well. And the thing is, the whole boat, and we're talking about a boat full of, again, the early, early guys. You mentioned Brock Pierce, but all the early guys from the 2017, 2016, 2014 days. And
2010
even, yeah. And the boat had SHIB hats, SHIB t-shirts, just for the record. And we had, I won't name names or people, but we had those Bitcoin OGs that would never in a million years talk about meme coins. Not only talk about their meme coin, one of them, again, I'd rather not mention names, acquired a meme coin, is building a whole kind of narrative behind it and kind of reviving the meme, which is a really interesting concept. So you bought up a whole bunch of the supply and is rebuilding it, pumped really well. I think in this case, meme coins are still the dominant narrative, other than obviously the gaming, Bitcoin, DePIN, etc.
Yeah, and I think maybe Paris and Dubai are two slightly different audiences in general, but we get into that. I mean, we should talk about the market. I see Simon has his hand up.
Simon, I don't know if you're on, I think someone's comments on what we talked about. Maybe we kick it off with like a market.
I'm sure. Well, let's
do a market update first. Simon, if you don't mind quickly, like
Joe, do that.
Now, Christopher, just kind of market update, you and Joe. And then we'll go to Hunter as well, kind of get an update on the ETF inflows and outflows. And of course, go to the rest of the panel since Simon. Chris or George, you want to take it off with the market update?
Sure, I can take it from my perspective. First, Mario, how does your neck feel after that picture? I don't know. You have to like look up and to the right. It's unbelievable. just looking at the markets, you know, the way I kind of see this is, when do things start to feel cheap? And when do things start to feel expensive? And, you know, a month ago, a lot of the meme coin and the altcoin market, it just started to feel a little expensive, right? And now we have, you know, looking at the 7-day now across some of the top coins that are out there that are moving today, you know, something like Stax is still down 20%, even though it's moved up 8% in the last 24 hours. You've got some meme coins like Book of Meme still down 25% in the last week, even though we're up 10% in the last 24 hours. And so things are starting to feel a little bit cheaper, I would say. You know, even like we were talking about Bitcoin ecosystem, something like Ordi, which is, you know, in the meme coin kind of category there, but, you know, on It's a BRC20. It's down 38%, almost 40% in the last week. But things are starting to move a little bit. So I think the market's starting to feel like, hey, things just feel a little bit cheaper. The halving is actually happening now, hopefully in the next 24 to 36 hours. And so I think we're just starting to see a little bit of a recovery. You also are starting to see some correlation between the broader markets and the cryptocurrency markets. And so that's also a piece here where stocks and everything have kind of rebounded and they've kind of been on a 5-day skid. So things are kind of starting to feel correlated. And I think the underlying theme of all of that is that the uncertainty around inflation, right? Everyone's kind of on this train of, hey, we're going to have 3 cuts this year or 5 cuts this year. And it just kind of keeps the goalposts keep moving. And so I think just that little uncertainty is what's kind of making everyone a little bit, squirming around, trying to figure out where things are going. And so it's kind of where we're at today. But things are way up in the last 24 hours and last hour here.
Let me go to, I know Scott, you're trying to fix your mic. Sorry, Nast or Romy, if you could please bring Scott down and back up. Let me go to Chris. Chris, would love your thoughts as well on the market. It's kind of an update, a bit of a technical analysis as well.
Yeah, I mean, I agree a lot with what was just said there. We're seeing a lot of them all, they took a big hit. They pulled back really significantly, but look like they're probably bottoming or pretty dang close to it. I'm kind of really looking at like Matic and Eagold and Mana right now, but I think more importantly probably is Bitcoin, because we're starting to see a lot of this this thing where it hasn't actually done anything, right? So we just dipped below the range low and we're right back up into it, but now we're hearing about this, oh my gosh, if we lose 50,000, there's like, I don't even remember how many 15 billion in liquidations possible or something like that. And so you start getting these really extreme views. And that's what I usually look for when I'm looking for, okay, is price potentially reversing or not? And so this morning, of course, we just now, as Scott was saying, we're getting a little bit of a rally this morning. We've got a wedge here coming down off about April 12th, that kind of swing high area up there. And we're breaking out impulsively through that. We've broken out impulsively through that this morning. So I'm liking the way this looks. To me, it looks like we just got a spring printing on the range there with the dip down there on Wednesday. It found support at the hourly S1 pivot, and we're rallying up now. So for me, the first step, the breakout, this impulsive breakout of this descending wedge resistance has happened now. The next thing I'm looking for is an impulsive breakout above the hourly pivot area right around, depends on what chart you're looking at, but right around 66,400 or so. And if we can get that, I think there's little use to be thinking about it going down any further. I think a lot of people are going to get caught waiting for it to come back down. If we do happen to get rejected, though, and drop down, I'm still looking at a sweep of 59,000, potentially hitting down to 56,000-57,000. But right now I think that's kind of where we're sitting.
Yeah, I think more importantly, hopefully you guys can hear me. I just couldn't hear Joe, which is why I signed off. But I think more importantly, we talked about for the last kind of month, or certainly a month ago, I was certainly saying, and a lot of us, that, we had this sort of meme coin madness, a lot of signals technically and just fundamentally that perhaps it was time to cool off. Certainly not to say a top is in, right? And we've seen Bitcoin effectively just range from 74,000 down to 60, right? And that same sort of euphoria we had at 74 when everything was overbought, like with RSI, I think we now have almost the opposite. Crazy, when we're kind of coming down to 60, you have panic and conversations about, is it over and is the top in, and things are oversold. Right. It's just the human emotion of it, that you're euphoric at the high. And that's why ranges even form, technically. But, listen, if there was a time to buy, I'm not saying it is or isn't, by the way. I have no idea where price will go. But at support, technically, when people are panicking is usually the good time to buy. And when meme coins are launching 1,000 a day and people are getting, rich overnight and then losing it, that's usually the time to at least temporarily exit. At least that, you know, in my opinion. So I think what we have now is a very obvious bounce off the range low instead of that sort of stop at the range highs. But really interesting market here. Dave, I saw you throwing up some emojis there. What do you think?
Well, I think a couple things. First, I'm completely in agreement with you on Bitcoin, and I'm completely in agreement with you on meme coins. You know that. We've talked about this many, many times. But there are a couple of things going on here. We saw a huge washout, like one of the largest of this cycle, of crypto hot money, right? You know, forced liquidations in crypto. And what you're seeing is a bifurcated market. I mean, actually, you know, if Bitcoin maxis are probably crowing, because if you look at the Bitcoin Ether ratio, it's decisively broke below 0.05. It's at 0.0048 something or other now. And that has traditionally been an area where you want to back up the truck on Ether relative to Bitcoin. But I think that what you actually are seeing is consistent new money trickling in, coming in, and, you know, into Bitcoin. And we, you know, we all know the ETF story, and I'm really curious what, let's see, is he on the panel here? Oh yeah, Hunter. Okay. I'd be really curious of what he thinks about this. But my thesis and what we see in flows is significant Bitcoin dominance, not just in market cap, but also in trading. And so what I think you see is a weak hand to strong hand shuffling, and a lot of people with serious regret. You know, people who trade altcoins to stack sats are unstacking sats by trading altcoins over the last month or two. And one wonders if they will learn that lesson. My guess is no, because as you would say, Scott, humans are going to human.
Absolutely right. Hunter, feel free to jump in there. Dave asked you the question, and I think it's always burning on our minds.
Hey, how you doing? Sounds like these images I'm seeing.
Hopefully, of Hunter, you chose you muted for me. I don't
know
if we're in a glitch.
Scott.
Oh, great. Okay, sorry.
Scott, I'm only muted for you. I hope that you guys are doing all right. I have a serious FOMO about Dubai until I saw photos of torrential downpour. I don't know if that's actually what you're experiencing, but looked crazy. On the ETF front, things are cooking. It's a good time. What can I say? So by the numbers, this week we've had across the ETFs about 400 million in outflows. We've been close to flat. We had seven million in outflows. Last week, 80 million in outflows. We had about 80 million in inflows last week. The week before that, about 500 million in inflows. We had about 50 million in inflows. BITB has been pretty steady. In the first quarter, we saw over 150 new firms and wealth teams buy a Bitwise fund, which was great to see. Those are firms who had not invested with us previously. So in addition to a few thousand firms that already use Bitwise funds. And then anecdotally, there's a lot in the works. My God, I've had 10 meetings in Chicago this week. We're doing internal trainings for platforms and RIAs. Bitwise was recently approved on a very large platform, and we're beginning the work of going to meet with all of the regional offices. People are very open-minded. I think if you're not looking at the screen every day, Bitcoin is up 40% year to date, and ETFs have gathered a historic amount of assets. I mean, people have probably heard everything there is to say about Bitcoin ETFs at this point, but prior to the Bitcoin ETFs, the fastest asset gathering ETF in history was QQQ, which gathered about $2 billion in a year. And the Bitwise Bitcoin ETF hit $2 billion in 2 months. And of course, you know, BlackRock has outpaced that. So I think from our client base's perspective, the asset class is now accessible. Some people have moved quickly. A lot of people are in the process and doing work in one form or another. So I think it's a very constructive outlook from ETF land. Some of the capital markets participants that are now considering the space for the first time, based on what I see.
Hey, Hunter, that's insanely bullish. Just hearing about all the untapped resources that are still out there. But in your opinion, what do you think the, you know, we've all got kind of our hit lists, right, of huge clients that we potentially want, and you know, you're, you know, knocking off as much as you can. What do you think is the largest untapped resource that you're looking at right now that you're like, man, if we can convert on this or get to this market, this is going to take it to the next level?
Well, I think that the, you know, so the US wealth market is, and I should mention that Andrew is a pretty good authority on the US wealth market as well, but somewhere around 30 trillion or maybe a bit higher than that. And about a third of it is independent RIAs, and about two thirds are bank and broker dealer platforms. So I think any approval by a bank or broker dealer platform is, of course, a huge opportunity set that opens. So we're working on where we recently got an approval. We're working on now connecting with those advisors. So I think that is a huge new area of opportunity. But of course, the RIAs are themselves also very, you know, a very massive part of the market. Maybe one thing I would say that perhaps could be novel relative to the conversation is that what we're witnessing is, it's not if you build it, they will come. I mean, so definitely it is appearing to be the case that the work has to be done. We, you know, do have to go have the meetings, talk people through their questions, them having access, while for a lot of investors, certainly they had conviction, they had a mental model, they were ready to go. I think the vast majority is still going to require a conversation, a training session, you know, and a bit of a process and support to feel confident with how they're going to utilize Bitcoin ETFs. So, you know, you've seen a few firms have been willing to speak about their platform approvals. Most of them have wanted it to be quiet, but it's not the case that you know, the home office says, okay, this is now available to you. And then every advisor across America just, you know, puts it into a portfolio the next day. What we're witnessing is again, that they then all need meetings. And for many of the firms, we'll go to their national, they have internal events for their advisors. And, you know, we'll go there and speak and do that work. So anyways, I think that all amounts to a large new part of the market is opening up, and the work has to be done, but we'll do it. And it's very constructive. And I'm very, very excited because I think this is a whole new cohort of you know, Bitcoiners and crypto savvy people out there. I mean, I just this week, several of the people at the RIA firms that we met with, they're very savvy and they have conviction. It's really exciting to see.
Love that. Scott, Hunter's all done. It's ground and pound, educating the RAs. Sin's got his hand up too, but happy to let you step back in.
Yeah, I'm happy I can hear. I'm very upset that I could not hear Hunter. Andrew, I'm going to assume that based on whatever Hunter said, which I was getting context and background, that you have some opinions.
Yeah, there's a listen, Bitwise is they're doing an absolute fantastic job on the ground. You know, I can speak to that not only on a, you know, macro but micro, knowing people in the space. They're really hitting it hard, and they're very, very well received. You know, when their teams, you know, end up in front of these folks, there's two ways to look at the medium term value associated with Bitcoin finding larger adoption from an investment standpoint at these organizations. One, the work that's being done, and this is what Hunter spoke to, of getting approved on a platform and then educating on a platform. Something that, you know, people need to be reminded of. Your average financial advisor is anywhere from 52 to 56 years old. Now, you know, I don't want to make a huge amount of, you know, assumptions of somebody at that age, but they're not 33 years old and, you know, figuring out MetaMask. So, you know, there has been some negativity around quote unquote crypto, you know, a lot of the shows that those types of folks are going to watch and the space that they're going to be in, there's been a lot of negativity. So those are the kind of educational hurdles that Bitwise is working through when they're having these meetings, right? We'd like to think that everybody is aware of Bitcoin, understands Bitcoin, and will look at the performance of Bitcoin over extended periods of time, and that makes sense. But that's not how human brains work, right? There's another side to the story. So there's an additional educational hurdle to overcome as it relates to, okay, can I put my clients in this? And, you know, am I not going to get burned? There's only one potential death knell in that type of business. And it's the compliance department, right? If you get a phone call because a customer complains from the compliance department, you are fighting for your life in that business. And if it goes wrong, you no longer are working in that business and you're fighting for your life to reboot your career in your 50s. Okay. Now I'm just trying to give context as it relates to that industry and the hurdles that Bitwise is working to overcome, not just by platforming their ETF and other ETFs, but the education process and people getting comfortable allocating and suggesting to customers to put their funds into Bitcoin ETFs. Now, that being said, over the next 6 to 9 months, there's going to be continued increases in 30 plus, you know, trillion in wealth having access to these products. That is absolutely going to keep a floor on the price of Bitcoin. There's no doubt about it. You know, we're looking at 30 days of range bound between an all-time high and now 63.7. That is a new paradigm of price movement. All of us, you know, because we've been here a long time, we're thinking, well, you know, we're going to see another 20-25% leg down because that's how Bitcoin works. I'm not so sure. I don't know. There's a floor that exists because of these products. You know, we've seen in the last couple of days a massive dump from Binance, continued dump from Grayscale. You know, these are things that, again, used to have enormous, you know, negative pressure on the price of Bitcoin. And the way that it holds up now is really, really something. But there will be continued, you know, I was given a note. Morgan Stanley is dragging their feet a little bit. There's some bureaucratic stuff going on inside of that organization. Wells Fargo is, quote unquote, surprisingly open and moving quickly towards a larger approval of the Bitcoin ETFs. There's positive momentum. It's all going to happen at these larger organizations. And it's my estimation that the floor associated with the price of Bitcoin will continue to press higher. Doesn't mean that guys like Scott aren't going to be right when things get frothy. There's reason for there to be pullbacks. But, you know, as it relates to Bitcoin and the price and the work that a guy like Hunter and his team is doing, you know, in a lot of ways, it's the Lord's work.
Hunter, I'm sure you're happy to hear that. And I won't hear your response, but go ahead.
we love doing the work. And I really
I'm in such a glitch. I can't tell if anyone else is talking.
Hey, Hunter's going. He's just laughing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I Andrew's spot on, and I appreciate it. It does feel sometimes like being, you know, an unpaid teaching assistant or something like that. But we're very, 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 very glad to do it. I will say, if it's interesting to this group, that one of the topics that I expect will be a topic for the traditional investment professional audience, really for the next year, is asset allocation. So, you know, most of these wealth managers construct a portfolio where they have, you know, they think through sizing different buckets. It might be U.S. domestic, international, different categories of fixed income, and with advisors and investors who want to include Bitcoin in the portfolio, one of the things they have to chew on, not always, they don't always have to, but often they have to chew on, okay, where am I going to put it? Does it go into sort of my risk bucket? Does it go into my alts bucket? Maybe they have hard assets or a real world assets, a real assets bucket. But they have to noodle a little bit on that and think through, am I going to view it as a risk asset, as a hedge, as an alt? And that comes up very frequently, and it has implications for, you know, what they sell, what they're going to sell to buy it, and what their expectations are for it. And because it has both high return potential but low correlations, there's a case to be made for a lot of different locations in the portfolio. So that might sound esoteric to some, but definitely is a focal point that is getting, you know, brought up in a lot of conversations, and I expect we'll be talking about for the year to come.
Hunter, I know that you've got, you know, you've got to be careful from a compliance standpoint and a bunch of different ways, you know, disclosures and whatnot. But as I describe the demographics of financial advisors, you know, mm-hmm. that 50 year age point and some of the thoughts that they have, if you can speak more generally to whether it's the kind of questions that you guys get, what are the nature of some of those questions? You know, am I completely off base as to kind of what I said there about, you know, kind of your typical advisors as you're meeting with these folks, or are you not necessarily you're meeting with advisors on the RIA side. So I don't know to what extent you can talk about it, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I think you were right on. The one thing I might add, so definitely, you know, wealth managers tend to be, you know, I don't know if the average is 50 or 60, but in that range, and they've been doing what they've been doing for a long time. Mm-hmm. And as you said, Andrew, you know, they lived through the .com, they lived through the great financial crisis, you know, they're trying to protect clients' wealth and you know, again, a lot of conversations. Sometimes, like, I'll have to hop off in a minute. I'm doing a teach-in for a large RIA. Sometimes they'll have questions about, you know, understanding the crypto landscape, but a lot of questions are what's happening in the market, what's the deal with the Bitcoin halving is recently topical. People are very interested in knowing what peers are doing. Mm-hmm. A fascinating phenomenon at the moment is that lots of firms are investing and doing work, and none of them are talking about it publicly. So if you just looked around on your LinkedIn, you would think that nobody has done a goddamn thing. Right. Because I think right now people just think there's no upside to being public about it. So there's sort of like this large cohort that has moved silently in the night. And so people are very interested in knowing what others and what peers are doing, and then asset allocation. You know, if they are interested, then asset allocation comes up because they have to figure that out. They have to say, if it's 1 or 2%, where is that coming from? You know, how are we thinking about where that's going? And then finally, one other piece, not to get too idiosyncratic or in the weeds of this topic, but you know, many firms have sort of they have advisors and then they have an investment team. Mm-hmm. And you know, the investment team, it could be strategists, analysts, research. And sometimes, you know, I just have to say, like, I love, there's so many great people on investment teams in wealth management firms across America who get it, and who are interested. And sometimes there's almost a challenge that they face, which is, we see it, we think it could be valuable. It's not yet widely accepted enough for us to shove it into the model or to put it in the model. Some of them are doing that, but for many of them, they say, we can't yet put it in the model because it's still not well enough understood by all the advisors. And if they put it in the model, it goes into every advisor's portfolio. Mm-hmm. And so how can we take a step forward here if we're not putting it in the model? And so, you know, sometimes they'll set up teach-ins for us so we can start to educate their advisors. Sometimes they'll connect us with some of their advisors who are particularly interested. But there's sort of two different cohorts inside of most firms. There's the investment team, and then there's the advisors. And if the investment team is not yet ready to put it in a model, then there's a question about how do you make the hop you know, from the conviction or understanding the investment team has to the advisors, who can use discretion to put specific things in portfolios, but are sometimes not as up to speed as the investment team. So,
well,
we usually juggle both.
And to give people some context to what Hunter is saying there, because he generally has to stay away from like firm names for compliance reasons, but I'll give you some examples. So there are investment arms at the likes of Goldman Sachs, There are investment arms at the likes of Dynasty. There are investment arms at the likes of Stifel. Those are three very different organizations. You know, obviously, Goldman Sachs is ultra high net worth. Everybody knows them. They're a super large organization. Stifel is considered a quote unquote regional. They have about 2,200 advisors across the country. Again, they have a big investment arm, research arm. Dynasty has the same. I don't know if anybody remembers Ron Insana from CNBC. He's now the head of investments in their investment arm at Dynasty. All of those organizations have investment and research arms that, you know, have different levels of understanding and comfortability with Bitcoin as an asset. And that in some way does or does not trickle down into the organizations. But those are three different types of scale of organizations that I can name that speak to exactly what Hunter was talking about.
Yeah. We do. Yeah. Love Stifel.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't mean to put you in an uncomfortable spot, but yeah. Well, there was a, you know, Goldman, one of the executives at Goldman came out like 2 weeks ago and said, you know, Bitcoin sucks, Bitcoin's garbage, right? Well, at the same time, you know, Goldman Sachs is begging, you know, BlackRock to be an authorized participant on their IBIT product, right? So there's a difference there. Like Goldman Sachs at some point will, Goldman Sachs has a very robust wealth management arm that lots of people don't know about. They've even bought in a couple of RIAs, you know, and brought them in-house, United. So, people don't know that about Goldman. They just think they're this big behemoth. Goldman will follow after the likes of Morgan Stanley and Wells Fargo and approve it for their wealth management advisors. There's layers to this.
Yeah. And Goldman is also an AP on the Bitwise Bitcoin ETF. And I think that they're getting more familiar with it through that, you know, dimension. On the Goldman topic, you know, it's worth noting that Goldman also doesn't believe that gold belongs in an asset allocation. They view it as a tactical asset. So these firms are not all the same, but so they all need to sort of be handled individually, as you have experience with Andrew.
Zooming out, I would just say it's
very, very exciting because you know, if each person on this call thinks about your network and how many investors you speak with and talk to about Bitcoin, you know, maybe it's 5, maybe it's 10. I mean, there's some people on here who are just incredibly influential individuals for whom it's many more, but most advisors have 50 to 100 clients. And so it makes me so happy with many of these firms as they're digging in and they're getting smart. And, you know, in a few meetings this week, I had questions like, do you think hash rate will drop after the halving? It's just really amazing. Bitcoin is entering the mainstream and this group has incredible reach and influence. And I think that we will get to a place where one day, you know, a lot of people are informed on the space. And so I'm grateful to a lot of the wealth managers and investment teams for spending the time because this is such a small part today of the 99 other things going on that they have to deal with. And I see a ton of progress. So I'm very optimistic. And I actually have to run to a meeting with an RIA now.
Thanks, Hunter. I just want to say, Hunter, if there's anyone that is capable of dealing with these intricacies, it sounds like you were the man for the job for all this stuff. So well done. Leading the industry.
We love what we do and love being part of this community. So thanks for having me on.
Tom, you had your hand up. I know Scott's kind of glitching a little bit.
Don't know you and Sins.
Yeah, all good. Good morning, everybody. So just wanted to hop in on a few points there. So actually chatted directly with the Goldman Digital Assets team the day their CIO made those comments, and they're directly investing in crypto. They are building things within crypto, and they're an authorized participant or trying to be on a lot of these ETFs. So, you know, I think we think of these organizations as more of a monolith, you know, rather than individual people who have opinions on these assets. So just a point there. And, you know, I think a lot of this comes down to career risk, right? You have people who need to. Yeah. Oh, still hear me?
Yep.
Go. Yeah, we can hear you.
Yep. Go.
Yeah,
we can hear you.
Okay, cool. Yeah, a lot of this comes down to career risk, especially for advisors, right? If you put in 1-3% of your portfolio into Bitcoin, you know, I think that's acceptable even for the most conservative person. But if you start upping that to 10-13%, you know, you're going to have potential issues. So they need to have track record, they need to have you know, institutional accountability, and the sort of the ETFs are building that over time. So, you know, we're going to continue to see more institutional flows as that sort of happens. You know, I had a conversation the other day when I was in Florida at my in-laws country club, and they had, you know, a high net worth individual advisor, and he advises, you know, in aggregate hundreds of millions of dollars, this person. And he said, you know, Jamie Dimon told me that Bitcoin doesn't make sense, so I'm still waiting to see if it makes sense. So there's a ton of folks like that who are still out there, a ton of folks who are in that older age cohort who still need to be convinced. And, you know, the longer these ETFs keep trading, and you know, the longer sample size we build, the more we'll be able to put the stuff in portfolios. So it's a time game, and it only goes one direction.
Yeah, there's going to be, Tom, that's really a really prescient comment. So assume you're like an advisor at Morgan Stanley or Goldman Sachs or Merrill Lynch or whatever it happens to be, and you're 62 years old, and those organizations, inside of those organizations, have very specific retirement outcomes for those types of advisors. They'll sell their business internally, and over a 4-year period, they'll end up banking $20, $25 million if they don't do anything other than have a couple meetings a day and don't screw up. Right. So the reality is that that type of advisor, now that says nothing about the 50-year-old guy who's asking about hash rate, but that 62-year-old advisor who's got a 4-year earnout to the tune of $25 million because of the business he's built over 30 years, that guy isn't pounding the table on, you know, a Bitcoin ETF. He's just not. So there are layers to this. And that was my point about the work that Bitwise is doing. I mean, it's involved stuff, and they're having conversations, you know, with RIAs. They're having conversations, you know, at regional levels of different types of firms. They're having conversations with the investment arms of some of these firms. It's not easy work, but they're doing it. But the point I'm making here, I'll give you a real example, like Morgan Stanley. I've got inside stuff on that place. They were set to approve not just in the ultra high net worth space at their PWM level, but across the entire platform on April 4th. Everything was supposed to be approved. That got stopped and pushed back. Why? Because of bureaucracy inside of the organization. And I can't give you any more than that. But, you know, it got pushed back. And part of that is, again, there are layers here. And I come back to that 60-year-old guy doing a $25 million earnout. That guy is really comfortable with saying, well, Jamie Dimon says so, right? Or Gorman says so, or such and such says so, and I don't want anybody messing with my money, right? Even though it's a 1% of a 1% type of thing that you could have a problem with one of these products, they don't want to take that. They're not interested in that risk. They've taken enough risk in their career for the last 30 years, gone through the dot-com bubble, got a couple complaints that they were able to deal with at that point. Could have derailed their career, right? Same thing in the financial crisis. Maybe another complaint that didn't go anywhere and they dealt with because they did the right things, right? They don't want that to happen again when they're staring down the barrel of retiring and moving on.
Yeah. So totally agree with all that. But I would also note that price follows, you know, narrative. So when Bitcoin has, you know, jumped up 2-4x, you're immediately going to get calls from your clients. If you're an RIA, saying, you know, why are we not considering this? So the longer price stays up, the better it is for that narrative as well. So it's sort of a perverse incentive in that regard.
Yeah, I agree with that. RIAs are a little bit different animal than a guy, you know, 32 years in at Morgan Stanley. The RIA guys are comfortable enough with risk that they decided to move away from an organization like Morgan Stanley, put their name on the front of the spot that they're at, and that's now how they're doing business. You know, with the back end of a Pershing or a Fidelity or a Schwab, and they're willing to go that route. So they're RIAs are inherently going to be more comfortable with risk. I think they'll lead, frankly, as it relates to adoption of Bitcoin ETFs. I will also note, because he's now gone, that the little quip that that Hunter made saying, we love Stiefel. My guess is they're probably doing a bit of a roadshow with Stiefel right now. And I also would bet that they're, there'll be an announcement, here in the next two to four weeks on, they're being on platform at Stiefel.
Great conversation, you guys. And just kind of looking at that, all of what you're saying is just the backbone of what has been this larger narrative of what's going on. And touching a little bit with what Scott and Mario in between their yacht parties are talking about, other things that are being built because of those tailwinds. We do have Raj up here from eMoney to talk a little bit about real world assets. Raj, if you're there, maybe just give us a little breakdown of, like what are the tailwinds from this kind of larger run up in Bitcoin, and how are you guys looking at real world assets and bringing that into what's going on?
Thank you. Thank you, Mario and Scott, for having me, first of all, in Cryptotown Hall. Thank you very much. We look at real-world assets as the next generation of way of bringing liquidity into the Web3. First of all, there is over 10 trillion market to tap into. But the main thing is, the biggest problem we are facing right now is how we will bring them into the Web3. If you look at, real world assets are different classes. We look at, for example, real estate, REITs, or shares, or commodities. Well, shares and commodities are quite easy to bring them into Web3, but something like real estate or REITs are very, very hard to bring them, because to prove the ownership, to prove the custody is very hard. And at the same time, the local compliance and regulations are something being also very, very challenging. For example, buying an apartment in Dubai is very easy because the local rules allows a foreigner to buy. But at the same time, buying an apartment in Hong Kong or in a different country is slightly hard, because there are some certain rules which needs only certain kind of citizens to buy it, and there are certain rules and regulations to be followed. So we need to maintain a golden policy with respect.
Raj, I think we lost you, unless I'm also rugged now.
Sorry. Can you hear me? Apologies. Hello?
Yep, I can hear you now.
Oh, thank you, Joe. So, I'll mention once again. So, there are different ways of it. What I'm trying to say here is that tokenizing a real-world asset is not as easy as minting an ERC-3643 token, because there are several things behind it. For example, a tokenized Tesla share, the question is, where is the custody of the Tesla share? For example, a tokenized an apartment, I fractionalized and a tokenized an apartment, let's say in Burj Khalifa. Now, the question is, do I really own the share of it? Do you really own the apartment? How are you going to prove the ownership? How are you going to prove the custody? That's the biggest drawback we are facing in real world asset bringing into the Web3 world. And that's why we have created, we separate this into four sections, which you call them as four pillars in Web3, which are proof of identity, proof of compliance, proof of ownership, and proof of custody. Without these four pillars, it's impossible. It's very hard to bring or to build RWA in Web3. And this is where we think.
Oh no, I'm sorry. I thought you were finished. I was going to say, miraculously, Raj, I just started to be able to hear you. Both Mario and I are having spaces glitches, so I'm glad I was catching up. But I'll let you finish. I was going to jump in with a question. Go ahead.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I hear you.
Yeah,
fine.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Scott. So bringing real world assets into Web3, it's a different stage process. So we really believe, following the compliance with the local regulations and building them exactly how we are building them in Web2 is the right way to build them or bring real world assets into the Web3 world. That's what we believe in. And to make it possible, we need to follow the right compliance procedure, as Andrew mentioned before, like following the local government policies, and on top of that, building the a proper procedure where to showcase the, for example, I buy a certain fraction of an apartment, tokenized apartment. It really proves that I'm the owner. For example, we can take an apartment in Burj Khalifa, fractionalize it into 100 parts, and then we can hand it over to a REIT in Dubai, let's say MR, through MR we got it, and then we can sell it as a token out into the market. I own one one token of this 100 tokens. Now I can go back to Imar and I can verify and I can confirm that, yes, I really own a fraction of the apartment that proves the ownership and also the custody of the apartment. So this is what is very much lacking in the industry right now. A lot of people are tokenizing a real world asset, let it be a share or a commodity, and then they're bringing into as an ERC-3643 or any other format, but where is the custody of it? Where is the ownership of it? That's the big problem we are facing in the real world asset right now.
Joe, I'm in and out. I'm listening.
All good. But, yeah, no, I had a question, Raj.
Just continue.
You know, I think people, you know, back with real world assets, you know, we used to just call it like security tokens, right? And I remember even it was like BTG Pactual started to do like security token offerings back in 2020. I think it's a decently sized bank in Brazil. What's the difference today between what's happening on that with versus what was happening in 2020? Where, you know, is it literally just the renaming from security token to real world asset, or is it the identity piece of what's happening here? Like these pillars you're talking about. Like, why is it going to work this time?
Just the answer is a very good question. Actually, the answer is. It's definitely possible this time is because we are exactly following the rules. For example, I have to mention about Mika over here as well, which is marketing crypto assets, which is coming in Europe very, very soon. The regulatory oversight makes things very easier. 4 years ago, there is no proper regulatory oversight, and everything is being done by just tokenizing and then calling it as I tokenized real world asset, but it's not really working, as I mentioned before, because of the lack of the four pillars, as I just mentioned before. But right now, now things are evolved. Now regulatory oversight is in place right now. And there is, for example, we can do KYC of the users. We have centralized institutions who can do the KYC and the custody of it. So things are more easier. And it's not just about the way we are doing it in a security or in another way as well. I mean, there are very, very difference between a security token and a tokenization of the real world asset, as I mentioned. Because of the changes in the regulatory oversight, and also not just about it, and also people are getting used to it. For example, 4 years ago, we don't really know exchanges doing KYC, but right now most of the exchanges are doing KYC. And of course, the giving out the data. Now, for example, the FATF travel rule was not there 4 years ago, but right now travel rule is there. For example, KYT is not there 4 years ago. Right now, Chainalysis is the biggest one doing KYT, and it became very, very common. And if you really want to run an exchange or a swap or an on-ramp, off-ramp, KYT is compulsory right now in the product nowadays. So people are getting used to the changes in the regulations, and they're accepting that, okay, no, this is common right now. Yes, KYT is common. Yes, KYC is common. More people accept the changes, it becomes more easy to bring RWA into real world, because we can't bring RWA into Web3 without passing through the compliance.
And with you know, Securitize and BlackRock, they just launched a tokenized fund, and they launched it on Ethereum, right? Which I think that was always a big question mark for everyone. You know, is, hey, is this sovereign nation going to launch like, you know, some sort of CBDC? Which chain did they launch it on? And I think it's pretty interesting to see BlackRock actually just choosing Ethereum. You know, even pre ETF, I think they're probably banking on an ETF getting approved. But what would be some of the other options? Like, why would someone choose to maybe build their own or white label something? You know, like if we're talking about banks, if we're talking about different projects, or are people just going to say, hey, we're just going to default to Ethereum?
So again, the difference is that Ethereum, there are several things, for example, here. We have Ripple doing it. It's a private network. But again, Ripple is available on Ethereum as well. Now, because Ripple has kind of tokens, certain amount of tokens out, which is whitelisted from their part, and then they are minted on Ethereum. It's in a similar way. Someone have the ownership of that. For example, BlackRock is tokenizing bond, and they're putting on Ethereum, which is fantastic. But the question is, who owns those bonds? Who are actually the seller? Technically, it's the BlackRock owns it. They whitelisted on their names, and they're putting on Ethereum. So similarly, this is where it is, things will change. For example, someone have to show the ownership of the security asset, and then you can put it on the Ethereum or Solana. Let's say Solana started token extensions 2 months ago, permission tokens on a permissionless chain, but there have to be an ownership of the token who owns it, which can run on the Solana network. That's something is important. That's where that's what we believe is that a compliance oversight of the tokens are accepted by somebody like BlackRock over there, and then it's given out in an Ethereum, which is like as a subsidize or a sublet of the share or the bond to the outside community.
But amazing. Yeah. As we wrap here, I know. Did you guys have an announcement today that you wanted to put out there? I think I've seen something in the background here about that.
We launched the testnet today, actually, which is the first public permission network, as I mentioned before. It's a network where it consists of all the four proofs. Projects building on Ethereum, Avalanche, Solana, as I mentioned before. So permission tokens on permissionless chains are coming very soon. It's great that blockchains are giving an option to add condition on the smart contracts, but to fulfill the condition, there have to be some checks to be done, right? So eMoney Network is the one which fulfills those checks and let users to pass through the four proofs and get them an account on other chains. But when they pass through the eMoney Network, they get a wallet on eMoney Network where the wallet address is an IBAN number. We are the first one to tokenize bank deposits as well, which is already live in the market. So we welcome people to go and test it and try it, very much like JP Morgan Onyx, but we made it public like Binance Smart Chain. So we're literally bringing the entire banking infrastructure into the blockchain world where which fulfills MiCA regulations, upcoming FCA regulations as well, which are nothing but the e-money tokens where the first ever stable coin always pegged 1:1 with a liquid currency in a bank account. Yeah, we launched it today. So welcome people to give and have a look at it, which is very, very unique and very different. It takes a while to understand, but it's as per MiCA regulations. Yeah.
Yeah, I did pin that. Did I hear that right? Where and how does that work with the IBAN number? Like if I wire money there, it goes to a wallet?
It's a good question. So what happened is that we are a bank, we are an offshore bank, and we are a blockchain as well, permission blockchain, as I mentioned, just like JP Morgan Onyx. So when you get a wallet, you have an IBAN over there, you send 1,000 euros to the IBAN, it creates equivalent amount of 1,000 euros on the chain, which is as per MiCA regulations of 2024 June 30, which is coming very soon. So you can send those e-money tokens from OX to OX. The real money moves in the background from IBAN to IBAN as well. It's always.
Oh, I think Raj got rugged again.
By the way, I think it needs to be mentioned that today's crypto town hall space is just epic level of quality. I don't know if that's associated with Mario and Scott being less available. I mean,
Not. I mean, the Crypto Town Hall is the hosting one. I mean, I've done 30 of these, you know, with the roundtable with Mario and Scott over the last, I would say, like 45 days. It is an absolute nightmare in the background on WhatsApp when people are like, I can't hear this person. I can't hear that person. What is going on?
Yeah,
it's like Twitter, X, I don't know, Elon has to get his shit figured out here soon because it is it completely breaks.
I just thoroughly enjoy giving Scott and Mario a hard time. I mean, that's the, you know, if I can do that once a day, I've had a good day. But yeah, it was a good one today. That information from Hunter and a little bit of a drill down there. He went a little further than he usually does. It's really good stuff.
Yeah, it's funny. He seemed kind of go ahead, bud.
Yeah, just I had prepared some ETF statistics because I followed that data very closely, mm-hmm. and I had my hand up earlier to jump in when Hunter was there to see what he thinks. So hopefully we'll talk about that sometime later. And also we didn't get to even talk about the halving, so probably a lot of cool stuff moving forward to talk about.
Yeah, unfortunately, the halving in California here is going to be on the 19th, so we don't get to celebrate, I guess, in the same way as the folks that have it on 420. So if you're, you know, in UTC or further east, depending on where you're at, you get it on 420, which is pretty exciting. But since you have anything on that you want to discuss real quick, or are you good?
No, I just don't want to belabor the point. I was hearing a lot of discussion online about whether having has an effect or not, because some people are looking at the chart and say, okay, immediately there's not a lot of effect. There's this always this camp that pops up every cycle that says it's all, you know, priced in for now, expecting a drop, and then some other people saying that in the longer and in several months later, you that's when you see the effects of it. So I have done an analysis of the average returns given how many months we move away after the halving. And the synopsis of that in one sentence is, generally for the first 5 months, you don't see anything. It's depressing, and that sort of fuels all that cognitive bias that, oh, nothing happens, it was all priced in. Then in month six, you see a little move, seven, eight, a little bit of a further move, and then the actual explosion starts after that. So that's how it summarizes for now.
Yeah, good stuff. And I think, you know, we're going from 900 Bitcoins a day to 450 on the market every day. So that's, you know, from 30 million a day or down to 30 million a day. So, you know, 900 million a month now, down from 1.8 billion. And in the grand scheme of things, it's not a huge amount. But that small amount is, you know, as they say, it's priced in, it's written into the code that we're going up because of it. So it will happen. But all right, you guys, we do have to wrap here. Appreciate everyone joining this morning. Thanks, Raj and eMoney. Everyone go give them a follow. And until next time, take care, y'all.